When Dan Roskinkowski, who was chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, was asked recently by a reporter if any of his checks had bounced in the congressional bank, he swore at the reporter. And then he sneered and he said, "None of your business." The question, he said, was an intrusion into his private affairs as a congressman. My older brother, who is a retired Army general who spent his last years in the Pentagon, spent some time with me recently, and we were talking about this and other profound events going on in the world. And he says, "You know, you need to understand that there are two worlds in Washington, D.C. There is the world inside the Beltway, and then there's the real world." And he says, "Nobody who lives inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C. understands the real world." Well, I thought a lot about that, and then I thought, you know, sometimes I think there are two worlds in the kingdom. There's one in the church, and then there's the real world. And very few people inside the church, it seems, understand the real world. Jimmy Swaggart, following his last escapade, stood before his congregation in Baton Rouge and told them that it's flat none of your business what he did with his personal life. Now, I'm not here to talk about Jimmy Swaggart because I think we ought to be grieving about that situation. But that's not living in the real world. I know from personal experience that God often allows entire ministries to crumble just to get the leader to the place to where he no longer relies upon himself, but relies upon God. I don't think that God gives a flip about giant ministries, whether they're on television or not on television, whether they have built buildings and hotels and amusement parks, or whether they are simply inside of huge church cathedrals and edifices. God really doesn't care about that. God is interested in people. And he's interested in bringing people to the point to where they rely upon him. Now let me make a statement this afternoon and hold on to this, because everything else centers around this particular statement. And the statement is this: God's greatest enemy in man is our self-confidence. God's greatest enemy in man is our self-confidence. And that everything God does is determined to tear that down. Now you see, that runs cross-grain to everything we have been taught in American politic and Western culture. We have been taught as Americans that we need to learn to be self-reliant. This is a nation that was born in rebellion We pride ourselves on going back to our roots of revolution against authority. And from that time on, in 1776 up until today, we still believe that we will never be fully successful or fully fulfilled until we are self-reliant, until we can stand on our own. The American dream is to be able to make enough money to where we don't have to rely on the government or on institutions or on a job or on anybody else. I have got enough money banked that I can make it. I am self-reliant. We want to be strong enough and healthy enough personally that we can walk through this life without having to lean on anybody else. We don't want to be reliant upon anybody else. The purpose of going into business or the purpose of getting an education is so we can develop our self-independence. My father said to the five Buckingham children, four boys and one baby sister, that he would give us an education. He said, I want to give that to you because that's the most important thing. He says, there'll be no inheritance to follow, but I'm going to give you an education because an education is one thing that nobody can take away from you. And if you are educated, you will learn to become self-reliant. That's the American way of life. That's the American culture. Now, that has crept over into the church as well, to where we as Christians believe the same thing. We pride ourselves on our independence. I grew up as a Southern Baptist, to where the most important doctrine we had as Southern Baptists was not the authority of the Scripture, but the autonomy of the local church. By God, we are independent. No, by God, we were not independent. We were independent without God. But our church was autonomous, and nobody could tell us what to do. And those of us inside the church were independent. I've seen that same thing infect the entire charismatic movement with a marvelous doctrine that I fully believe in called the priesthood of all believers. I powerfully believe in the priesthood of all believers. I think it's a wonderful doctrine that is taught in the Bible, that every one of us stands independent before God as a priest. But see, we have carried it just a little bit beyond, and we have mixed our Western culture with it to where we put more emphasis on our independence than we do on our before God. Nobody can tell me what I believe. And so I am independent before God. And we have developed a whole group of people, and some of you are numbered among them, who never can settle down in any church, any place, because you are independent. And so you are constantly looking either for a perfect situation or you're looking for a situation where you're in charge. And you move from one body of people to another, blessing everybody as you go along, roller skate Christians. Independent. Now God's greatest enemy in man is our self-confidence. And everything that God does is determined to tear that down. Now, if a man will not willfully humble himself before God, God will lovingly humiliate him before man. Hear that, please. If man will not willfully humble himself before God, God will lovingly humiliate him before mankind. Now, we have seen case after case after case of that in high-profile ministries. General Westmoreland was right when he said, the higher the monkey climbs the flagpole, the more he shows his backside. Only Westmoreland didn't use exactly that kind of language. I've cleaned it up a little bit for television. You see, I believe that the media, and we curse it all the time, I believe that the media is God's gift to the church to keep us honest. And so are the courts. And so are our wives. Remember being with Oral Roberts a couple of years ago? Oral had had the IRS inside of their ministry for 7 years. By that I mean the IRS had placed people inside Oral Roberts Ministry and Oral Roberts Universities and Oral Roberts Evangelistic Association, had assigned them specifically, sometimes two, sometimes three, who had full-time jobs investigating the Oral Roberts ministries. And Oral had talked to me about it on a number of occasions. He said, I just can't understand this, can't understand. He said, I don't know what they're after, but they're in there harassing us all the time, just harassing us all the time. He says, my lawyers tell me I can't talk to them. He said, just keep away from them. Well, a couple of years ago, he got so fed up with the whole thing that he just got in his private plane, flew to Washington, D.C., and got an appointment with the deputy, the assistant director of the Internal Revenue Service, and went in and sat down with him and said, what's going on? And he said he came back from that meeting an enlightened individual. He said, I discovered that they weren't harassing us. I discovered that they had but one thing in mind. They wanted me to comply with the law. He said that was a wonderful revelation that he had. He said his lawyers had never told him that. Nobody in his youth had ever told him that. That all the government agencies wanted him to do was to comply with the law. He said, why, that's the easiest thing in the world to do. He fired all of his lawyers in Tulsa. And said, all I have to do is obey the law. He started complying with the law. IRS pulled out. They haven't been back since. God's gift to the church to bring us to a place of honesty. That instead of being cocky and independent, that we are reliant and dependent. See, I believe that God allows that to happen because there's something inside of all of us that wells up constantly that says, I'm in charge. I can do it. Now, a cancer diagnosis goes a long way to change that. Especially if they tell you it's inoperable and incurable. That'll bring you up to a really screeching halt on the whole business of self-reliance and self-confidence. And I went through that last year, and it was a wonderful experience, and emerged out of it a whole different individual. Changed my relationship with my wife, changed it drastically with my wife. Because we had been going two separate ways. Now, actually not two separate ways. We were going the same way, but we were walking two separate paths, side by side. But not united, not really touching, just side by side. But not together. And for a year, I had all of that knocked out from under me. I mean, Jackie and I have gone through a year of bliss. She says it's bliss because I do everything she tells me to do. She makes the carrot juice, I drink it. Hate the stuff. It's terrible. Especially when she mixes beets with it. Spinach, other things. But all of these things are supposedly designed to keep me healthy, and so I don't get to eat any of the good stuff anymore. She's shaking her head over here. She said, well, just when you sneak it a little bit, like those chocolate chip cookies for lunch. But but we've been through it. We've been through a year of bliss. Now, there have been a couple of times where the old me has risen back up. Not many. And each time it's happened, God has been gracious enough to remind me in a drastic kind of way that I'm not to live that kind of life anymore. I remember exactly when the first time it happened. We'd gone through a year, maybe 13, 14 months of just... everything was lovey-dovey. It had not been a single crossword. There was no need for a crossword because this whole love relationship had developed so deeply. And then finally, there was one of those days, and she was in the kitchen peeling carrots and doing all this stuff. And I walked in, and she said, I'm getting ready to make the carrot juice, and you're supposed to drink it. And I just couldn't take any more of that stuff. I mean, I just gag on it, trying to get it down. Because I would drink it. If I drink it really fast, it's not quite so bad, especially if I stir it all the time while I'm drinking it, so that stuff doesn't settle to the bottom. And anyway, I said something to her. That's the first time in 14 months, 15 months that I'd said anything to her. I just said, I can't take it anymore. And she said, you promised God you're going to change your lifestyle. You promised God you're going to change your diet. You promised God that you're going to do what I told you to do. And the old me rose up against that kind of thing, and I just said, there's enough of this. This is it. And we had a couple of words back and forth, and I reverted. Went back to the animalistic state. And standing in the kitchen looking for something to throw. This has always been my way of handling things like that, was to throw something. And yet I knew I shouldn't throw anything hard because that would... And the only thing I'd get my hands on was a banana that was on the... Grabbed that thing and just smashed it with everything... Wham! Against the floor as hard as I could and stormed out of the kitchen. Went in the den, realized there she is standing at the sink peeling carrots trying to keep me alive, and I've smashed the banana on the floor. And then I thought, but the man is supposed to have authority over his wife. So I went storming back into the kitchen to shout, I'm in charge, and the moment I got into the kitchen, I stepped into the banana. I can't demonstrate it, Mitten, but my feet went out from under me. I slid all the way across the kitchen and slammed into the refrigerator on the other side. Had banana all over my backside. Oh. I had heard about people who had slipped on bananas, but... And then I couldn't get up. I mean, I was in this kind of bent, crooked position. I'd had radiation treatment on my back, and I said, I've broken my back. I can't move. I'm laying here. I got one foot kind of cocked under me and underneath the butcher block, which sits in the middle of the kitchen, and the other crammed up underneath the refrigerator. And Jackie hadn't heard any of this. She's still standing at the sink. Working on the carrots. And I thought, man who does not willfully humble himself before God will be lovingly humiliated. And so lying there in that position with banana all over me and all twisted and turned and everything, afraid to move, afraid I'd broken something really vital. I had to call to my wife, "Help, help." She turned and looked at me and saw me there on the floor and said, "What in the world is wrong?" And I, well, I stepped in the banana. It really turned out all right. She got down beside me and we both just sat there and laughed in the middle of the floor. And finally she pulled me up, and we have not had another one since then, have we? God was very gracious, and I didn't break my back, and I've still got a knot on my leg from it. But I understand that self-reliance and self-confidence is God's greatest enemy. And that God will do anything possible to break that down in us until we are at a place of reliance upon Him. What is it in your life that is the most important thing? Last night, when Bob called on us to cry out, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me," what is it that you would have God do for you? And then respond to that. What is it you really want from God? And I began to realize that the thing I really wanted from God was something really selfish. Something really selfish. I wanted something for me. I wasn't really saying, "Lord, what I really want from you is to walk with you in the cool of the evening in the garden." No. What I want is my sight. What I want is assurance that the cancer will never come back. What I want is whatever. I chided myself after I left here for asking for something less than what God really wants for me. Now, I know that He wants me healed. See, I'm not saying that. But I also know that one of the reasons I want to be healed is so I can make it on my own again. It scares me. I want to be healthy so I don't have to keep calling on Him all the time for my health. And I'm not sure He'll ever let me be without pain until I reach a stage to where I call on Him whether I have pain or don't have pain. See, I think we need to understand that God has design and purpose for our lives. And that climbing the flagpole is a dangerous thing to do. Because we really do expose our backsides. I've got some friends who are in the televangelism ministry. Basically, it's television. I ought to call it telemoney ministry, but anyway, it's whatever. They're television preachers, and they sometimes, some of this is ordained of God, and some of it's ordained of man. But I've got some friends in that crowd who have pushed themselves into the public eye. Everything they do is designed for public exposure, and then they seem to be shocked when people react to their extravagance or less than godly lifestyle. One TV preacher who drives a $100,000 Bentley automobile seemed to be genuinely baffled when I talked to him last week because he was being criticized in the press, who had called him flamboyant. I mean, he was really upset about this, baffled about it. And so I ask him, but why do you drive a $100,000 Bentley? And he replied with what I assume was a straight face over the telephone. He says, a man in my kind of ministry needs good, solid transportation. Now, he too is out of touch. He's not living in the real world. Time magazine criticized our congressmen for placing themselves above the law. And Time, God's gift to keep us honest, accused them of the sin of cultural privilege and protection. Unfortunately, it's the same problem that plagued many Christians who pride themselves on their priesthood and their independence, but don't know how to live when they are their own employer. There's a new fun movie out called City Slickers. Interesting movie. Jackie and I watched on the plane coming back from California a couple of weeks ago. And in the movie, there's a conversation carried on between two married men. It's a movie about three middle-aged married fellas who think they are losing their masculinity because they're growing older. All men seem to think that they lose their masculinity when they grow older. Loss of hair is a symbol of being impotent. And so Billy Crystal, who's the star of the movie, was looking in the mirror, and he says, I've lost hair where I should have it, and I'm growing it where I shouldn't. Look, it's in my nose now. And so they decide, these three guys get together, and they decide that they're going to go to the Wild West and take a two-week cattle drive, where they're going to drive cattle across the prairies, going up from New Mexico or Arizona to Colorado. And they plan their two-week vacation to join this cattle drive in the Old West. And one night around the campfire, two of them get into a conversation. And one of them asked the other, he said, would you commit adultery if there is no way that your wife could ever find out about it? Would you commit adultery if there was no way that no one else in the world could ever find out about it? Now, it's a good question, because it strikes at the heart of all ethics. In a recent survey, and some of you saw this back in the late spring, 72% of Americans who were surveyed said they would not commit adultery for $100. But they would do it for $7 million. In the movie, Billy Crystal gives the right answer. In essence, what he says, values are not determined by who knows. They are absolute even when no one else is watching. Unfortunately, sticking with values because they're right, not because you might get caught if you violate them, seems to be a fading character quality, certainly in Congress and too often among Christians. And so let me go back to my theme, and I want to wrap this thing up with this. God's greatest enemy in man is our self-confidence. And everything God does is determined to tear that down. In Psalm 102, verse 23. Psalm 102, verse 23. The NIV says, quoting David, "In the course of my life, he broke my strength." A better translation, a literal translation, is "he has weakened my strength in the way." He has weakened my strength in the way. God loves us enough to weaken our strength. The passage that Jack was referring to this morning from 2 Corinthians 12. "My strength is made perfect in your" what? "Weakness. In order that my grace will be sufficient for you." For His grace will never be sufficient for us if we are strong. Only in our weakness does His strength manifest. Only when you have lost everything is the strength of God and the power of God and the glory of God really manifested. Which means if you have something in your life that you are holding on to dearly and doing everything you can to keep from losing, God will take that away to the place that you don't care anymore. And that includes, by the way, or perhaps starts, by the way, with your physical life. As long as you are holding on to that. The afternoon I came home from the doctor, June 29, 1990, Friday afternoon, I sat in my den and told Jackie what the doctor had said. We went through our initial reactions. And then we spent the next 2 hours just sitting there on the little love seat in our den. House was empty. Doing something we had not done in years. Gripping each other very tightly and praying out loud together. You know, it's amazing how so many people in public ministry, myself included, don't pray with their wives. Or if they do, their prayers at the table or prayers on special occasions of some kind. But I'm talking about involving God in the union, where He comes in and He's there and He permeates everything, and you forget about the fact that your spouse is there, and you're in conversation with your father. And you're interrupting each other as you pray. And I began to realize as we did this, strangest kind of thing, I wasn't praying for my life. I just heard the doctor say just a couple of hours before that I was going to die. But that wasn't the heart cry that was coming out of me. Jackie was sitting there with me, and I was weeping. But what I was crying for was not, "Lord, save my life." But rather it was, "Lord, I want to see your face." I want to be in your presence. somehow I sensed that if I were in his presence, everything would be all right. And then I wouldn't have to give orders to God about life and death, health and medication, treatment, and all those things that I knew nothing about. Just let me be in your presence. We've been that way ever since. He has weakened my strength in the way. You see, the human understanding of the anointing of God is strength. God's man of faith and power. His understanding is human weakness, which relies upon God. Let me show you something in the Bible, just for a few moments. Go to the 13th chapter of the book of Judges. It's a familiar story. Story of Samson, Judges 13. You know, Israel, the nation of Israel, strange kind of government. They had been under the government of Moses as they came out of Egypt, done all their wanderings in the Sinai. Then Moses had passed along the authority to Joshua, who had taken it over, and Joshua led them from that wilderness experience into the land of Canaan, where they conquered most of the cities. And they established tribal boundaries inside the land of Canaan, with a couple of the tribes outside over in the Jordan side, on the east side of the Jordan, but most of them inside of the what is now the present-day land of Israel, had tribal boundaries. And each one of these tribes had tribal leaders who were over them, and they pretty well functioned independently, much as the states in the United States function independently. Until there was a time of crisis. And then when there was a time of crisis, if one tribe were attacked, or if the attack was coming from the north and it was involving several tribes, then all of them would band together under one common leader called a judge. And that leader would function only as long as the crisis lasted, and then that leader would step back and go back to whatever he or she was doing. Deborah was a judge. Gideon was a judge. Samson was a judge. Nation was under attack by the Philistines, coming up from the Gaza Strip. And Samson rose up as a judge, very unlikely man, very ungodly man. Interesting kind of fellow. And yet God chose him, even though Samson didn't choose God. I want to show you some passages here. In the last part of the 13th chapter of Judges, verse 24, the woman gave birth to a boy and named him Samson. He grew and the Lord blessed him, and the Spirit of the Lord began to stir him. I have circled that little phrase. The Spirit of the Lord began to stir him. Go on down to chapter 14. Verse 5. Samson went down to Timnah. Timnah's down near Eilat. It's a copper mining place down in the far south of Israel, the far part of the Negev Desert. Samson went down to Timnah together with his father and mother, and as they approached the vineyards of Timnah, suddenly a young lion came roaring toward them. Verse 6, the Spirit of the Lord came upon him in power. Phrases used again. The Spirit of the Lord came on Samson. Go over to verse 19. We find it again. Samson is now growing up. He's now a young man. And the Spirit of the Lord, verse 19, chapter 14, verse 19. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him in power, and he went down to Ashkelon in Gaza, and struck down 30 of their men, Philistines, stripped them of their belongings, and gave their clothes to those who had explained the riddle. Burning with anger, he went up to his father's house, and Samson's wife was given to the friend who had attended him at the wedding. Each time we find the Spirit of the Lord came upon Samson. Now you remember Samson had taken a vow as a Nazarite, as a child, or at least his parents had taken the vow for him, perhaps. Two basic things about a Nazarite. By the way, Nazarites were not from Nazareth. It has nothing to do with the community of Nazareth. But the vow of the Nazarite simply was that no strong drink would ever touch his lips and that he would let his hair grow. He would never cut his hair. And so no razor had come upon him, and he did not take strong drink. And Samson began, mistakenly, to believe that his strength lay in the fact that he didn't take strong drink and that his hair had grown long. Now, the scriptures never say that, by the way. But Samson says that. Go over to chapter 15. Verse 14. As he approached Lehi, the Philistines came toward him shouting, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon him in power, and the ropes on his arms became like charred flax, and the bindings dropped from his hands, and finding a fresh jawbone of a donkey, he grabbed it and struck down 1,000 men. And then Samson made a terrible mistake. He fell in love with an enemy spy. Philistines sent a young woman into his camp to seduce him because they found out that Samson had a penchant for young women. He was running around with everybody, it seems. And so they hit him at his place of weakness and sent this young woman by the name of Delilah to be their spy. And he was naive and he fell in love with her. And she kind of toyed with him a little bit, trying to find the source of his strength. And finally, go over to verse chapter 16, verse 18. Chapter 16, verse 18. When Delilah saw that he had told her everything, she sent word to the rulers of the Philistines. Come back once more, he has told me everything. And so the rulers of the Philistines returned with silver in their hands. They paid her off. Having put him to sleep on her lap, she called a man to shave off the 7 braids of his hair. And so he began to subdue him, and his strength left him. And then she calls Samson, the Philistines are upon you. And one of the saddest verses of all the Bible is the last part of that 20th verse. And he awoke from his sleep and thought, I'll go out as before and shake myself free. But he did not know that the Lord had left him. Samson's strength was not in his hair. Samson's strength was in the Lord. And this time he had gone too far. He had compromised too much. He had become so cocky and so self-reliant and so self-confident that God said, it's time to break him. And he broke him. And he went out and shook himself before the Philistines and did not know, the King James says, wist not that the Lord had departed from him. The Philistines seized him and gouged out his eyes, probably with hot pokers, by the way, and took him down to Gaza, and binding him with bronze shackles, they set him to grinding in the prison. But the hair on his head began to grow again after it had been shaved. And now the rulers of the Philistines assembled to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god, and to celebrate, saying, our God has delivered Samson, our enemy, into our hands. And when the people saw him, they praised their God, saying, our God has delivered our enemy into our hands, the one who laid waste our land and multiplied our slain. And while they were high in high spirits, they shouted, bring out Samson to entertain us. And so they called Samson out of the prison, and he performed for them. And when they stood him among the pillars, Samson said to the servant who held his hand, put me where I can feel the pillars that support the temple, and so that I may lean against them. Now the temple was crowded with men and women, and all the rulers of the Philistines were there, and on the roof were about 3,000 men and women watching Samson perform. And then Samson prayed to the Lord. This is the first time in all of the story of Samson that we find him praying to the Lord. There's not an instance before where he relied upon the Lord. Now he's blind. He's lost his strength. He's an object of ridicule. He's humiliated before the entire nation. The great judge of Israel is now brought out as a chief entertainer, and he prays before the Lord. And Samson prayed to the Lord, "O sovereign God, remember me. O God, please strengthen me just once more. And let me with one blow get revenge on the Philistines for my two eyes." And then Samson reached toward the two central pillars on which the temple stood, and bracing himself against them, his right hand on one and his left hand on the other, Samson said, "Let me die with the Philistines." And he pushed with all his might, and down came the temple on the rulers and all the people in it. And thus he killed many more when he died than when he lived. There's not a day goes by in my life when I do not pray that prayer of Samson. Oh Lord, remember me. Give me one more chance. That's all. There's not a time when I stand to speak that I don't, in my mind's eye, feel myself groping for the pillars to put my hands against Satan's temple and to say, "Lord, just one more time. One more time." Paul Kane came through Melbourne, Florida last year. He had called ahead of time. We had arranged for him to come and have lunch with us and spend part of the afternoon with us. I respect Paul. I really do believe he's a prophet of God. And Paul said to me earlier, he said, I have something that I think will help you maintain your healing. Well, when a prophet of God says that to me, I say, "Come into my house." I thought he was talking about my diets and more carrot juice. Instead, he came in and talked to me personally and intimately about staying close to God. And I realized that diet and nutrition and exercise, all of those things, as important as they are, nothing is as important as walking with Him. Human strength must be exchanged for dependence upon God. I'm aware of the fact that there are a lot of you here whose lives are like the life that Jack described this morning, the life that Paul lived, filled with thorns. I dare say there's probably nobody in this room who doesn't have some kind of thorn in your flesh. Everybody's here has got something, and for some that's a lot more serious than it is for others. There's some of you here who have lost everything recently, financially. There's some of you here who have received medical death sentence on your life, and you're living with that right now. There's some of you here whose homes have fallen apart. There's some men of God here whose wives have walked away from them. And there's some women here whose husbands, once strong in the Lord, have turned and walked away from them. Everybody here has got some kind of thorn. Some of those thorns are pretty deep and they dig pretty hard. Broken bodies and broken minds and broken hearts. Can I say something to you, and I will close with this. This will be the last thing I'll say, but I want to say this to you, and I want to say it with all kindness and with all gentleness. God loves you very much. He has plan and purpose for you. Anything in your life that you're holding on to can become an idol. And God will jerk that down because He loves you. And therefore, what I want to say to you is this. Stop complaining about weakness and glory in God's strength. And leave the future with Him. It's already spelled out in this book. Promises are secure, but they will never be yours until you allow Him to fulfill them in your life. Close your eyes for a minute, please. There's nothing wrong with being afraid. It's a human emotion. It's a normal sign of weakness. And God is blessed when you are weak. There's nothing wrong with being afraid as long as you can say, "What time I am afraid, I will trust in you." Everything Jesus did at the cross was designed to bring you to a place to where you have open recourse to the Father. Not to ask Him for your selfish needs, but to have fellowship with Him. You say, "Well, didn't Bartimaeus cry out for his sight?" Of course he cried out for his sight. It's the most normal thing in the world. If you're blind and you're a beggar, you cry out for your sight. If you're dying, you cry out for health. Of course you do. But I am saying, go one step beyond that. And simply say to Him, "Whatever you want to give me, I will take. Now here's my needs as I perceive them. But what I really want is you." And you will find that when He gives Himself, all of your needs are met. I pray that you hear the cry of our heart for Jesus' sake. Amen.